Welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen. We got another show of Aaron's Gun Shop, High Cap Adventures radio show. If you don't recognize the voice, that's because this is Benton Ross Watson. I'm taking over for Matt today. He had some things he had to take care of, and that's right. So I've got the bull by the horns, and I'm in control. So hang on. We got a good show for you. Today we got... First, we got three more true stories of self-defense from the American Rifleman Armed Citizen column. We're going to learn from others what to do and what not to do as far as defending ourselves and our loved ones and our property. In today's LTC attorney segment, I'll be talking with Rick Dodd, attorney at Capolino, Dodd & Krebs here in Cameron. We're going to be talking about the risks of selling your firearms to other people and not using a gun dealer. It's legal, of course, but let's talk about the possible risks and the liabilities of selling them on your own. Next to today's topic of interest segment, you will learn some more about the upcoming events with Aaron's gun shop and how you can get involved. The next will be our tactical snacking segment with Janae Goodman. This week's topic is sausages. Sausages, right? That's perfect after Worst Fest last week. But the recipes and the methods on how to make good sausage at home. At 11 a.m., the voice of law enforcement, retired police chief Randy Dixon, which is a communicator of common sense, the master of manners, the epitome of encyclopedia, and an all-around good guy. Randy Dixon, the voice of law enforcement. Today's product spotlight, again sponsored by A&C Firearms. The guys down there with Arch Kuntz and Heidenheimer, it's the Glock 21 and the 22 conversion kit combo. Go to aaronsgunshop.com, the Facebook page. Look at the pictures of the package deal. We're going to read all about it and talk about the product in the product spotlight segment. I have a special guest today. I'm really excited. He's going to be here. His name is John Reddington, the assistant district attorney for Falls County, former district attorney. Assistant District Attorney for Milam County, and he's also the City Prosecutor for Cameron, and was a great defense lawyer. I'm really excited about this interview. It's good to have a perspective from somebody that's on the public official side. And finally, Master Cindy Key will give some words of wisdom and tactics for self-defense. Master Key owns Central Texas Martial Arts in Rockdale. So let's just get started. We're getting started with the NRA. Three stories from the NRA's Armed Citizen page, the American Rifleman. Hopefully from these stories we can learn what to do and what not to do as far as protecting ourselves, our loved ones, and our property. If you're not a member of the NRA, you might consider becoming one. The more gun supporters they have, the more muscle they have to stop bad legislation. So after reading these, if contact the most local office of the NRA and try to become a member today. First, there was in August of 2017 in Salinas, Kansas, drugs are thought to have played a role in the case of a man who was held at gunpoint when he was caught allegedly attempting to steal a vehicle. The Kansas resident was awakened by his dog barking, and he grabs his gun and he goes to check out what's going on. And he checks and he searches the home, and during the search, it took him outside where he spotted a stranger sitting in his truck. The resident approached the truck and held the interloper at gunpoint until the police arrived. The alleged robber was arrested. Police found a variety of drugs and paraphernalia in his possession. He faces illegal substance and trespassing charges. Now, Matt would probably tell you that the man took control of the situation, which was a good thing. He assessed his environment. He prepared himself. He did not panic. He grabbed his weapon and did a search so that he was under control of the premises. And when he made it outside, he did not fly off the cuff. He simply assessed the threat, analyzed the threat, and subdued the thief by simply pulling out his firearm. And we all know from the legal standpoint that it's not deadly force to simply pull your firearm, but it is justified. However, you can use deadly force when we're talking about defensive property, when you have theft at nighttime. It doesn't give the exact time of day, but the man was awakened, and so I assume that it was dark outside, and so there's no reason why this man shouldn't be commended and absolutely justified. The second story is, we know that women stick together, but this is especially true when it's in defense of a friend, and that's what happened when a Nebraska shooting that followed an alleged domestic assault. The victim's ex-boyfriend reportedly had been engaging in stalking behavior before things came to a head in early August. That was of this year. That day, the district attorney said the former lover showed up at the house and physically attacked his ex, throwing her to the ground and putting his hands around her neck. When she escaped from his clutches, he struck with the piece of pipe, verbally threatening to kill her. One of the victim's friends then pulled up and pulled out her gun and told him to stop. He sneered at her. "Go ahead and shoot," he said, and raised the pipe to strike again. Well, the armed citizen fired, hitting him in the abdomen. The man faces a series of charges related to his ex-girlfriend's broken arm and bruises. Obviously, we know that we can, thank goodness that she had the guts and courage to put herself in that situation. And thank goodness she knew what she was doing with the weapon, which is all the more reason to have the LTC licensed and to be trained in what you're doing, but and to follow through with her training, and or at least with her threat that she would shoot. And from the standpoint, we obviously know that you have a defense of third persons, and so she was absolutely justified from a legal standpoint, and nothing was at all wrong with what she did. And again, this happened in Omaha, Nebraska, in August of this year. The third story, the takeaway, it's never too late to apply for a concealed carry permit. And that was especially true for a Detroit, Michigan resident in August of this year. The man had recently turned 61 and had finally decided to get his license to carry. And luckily for him that the officials granted it, and he had got it when he did, because the need to defend himself arose very quickly. Very shortly after getting it that morning, that he goes to get a cup of Joe from the convenience store. And while he's standing in line, a 16-year-old pressed a gun up to his back and tried to rob him. The older man tried reasoning with the boy to get him to, you know, rethink the situation. But the man ended up having to pull his gun and shoot. The teen is being tried as an adult and facing charges that include assault with intent to kill. I mean, it's actually pretty impressive, right? I mean, he had the gun to his back and he's able to pull his firearm in such a way without getting shot. It was probably a 16-year-old, which may have been nervous in the situation, but still, I mean, he had enough awareness and calmness and courage in the situation to take control of the situation and not be a victim. And even to reason with the kid, I think, was impressive. And so, holler at Matt Betros at aaronsgunshop.com. He owns Aaron's Gun Shop, and you can check him out on the Facebook page. You can also email him at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com. You can ask him for any questions about the LTC program. They have a bunch of great offers. He took me this just a few days ago, and they've got this building set up, and he made a custom me. I think I'm gonna pay for a class, but it's pretty awesome, and you ought to go check it out. And that brings me to the opinion piece, and my first, I guess, opinions piece is my piece, and it starts with WTF, Matt. And so these are my WTF moments. And you know, not to give somebody with ADHD without any subject matter, topic, or direction, to say pick your own opinion piece. And so WTF, Matt. And speaking of ADHD, and it was like when my teacher put me out in the hallway, and she didn't give me a topic or a subject matter or a direction. She just gave me a piece of paper and told me to go start writing a paper. Well, I was in the hallway for 2 weeks, and I ended up missing the two pep rallies out of the deal. But are you just so lazy that you can't teach me anything? You can't give me a topic matter? You just want to leave me out in the hallway? WTF. It's like the common culture. And so what is ADHD anyway? Because when you really think about it, Big Pharma in the last decade, 53% rise in ADHD medication. ADHD was created 3 decades ago, and statistically, every single decade, there's a rise. And now the top people that made the DSM and the ADHD manual say that they're not even diagnosing what they thought they were supposed to diagnose it with. I think that this is a societal problem. It's the prognosis of a discrepancy fueled by Big Pharma, of overworked teachers, psychiatrists, and stressed out parents, a Papa Pill mentality, and our microwave culture. We just don't want to take the effort into teaching kids that are bored. We're bored. We don't need medication and all kinds of pills and things. They're coming out with a new one. Sluggish cognitive tempo, or SCT disorder. And the New York Times has already said that Eli Lilly has profited off of showing that this is a reason to sell their new drug Strattera, which happens to be for ADHD. WTF. ADHDers don't have a problem. In fact, one of the ADHD Advantage author, Dr. Dale Archer, suggests that ADHD and Asperger syndrome are superhuman mutations that exist to push society forward. We are a people of an explorer, Gene. We're hunters in a farmer's society. We're bored. And again, and so that brings me to the daylight savings time. I get so bored every day. It's supposed to be daylight savings time, but yet I can't go hunting because it's dark when I get off work. I mean, what's wrong with WTF, daylight savings time? And guess who came up with it? That's right, Benjamin Franklin. And as Dr. Dale Archer said, he probably had ADHD, and I quote, in abundance. And so, and we're talking, and speaking of daylight savings time, stop calling this show for Rural Party Line. Okay, maybe you've got daylight savings time messed up. Stop calling the show WTF. It starts before the show. And then that brings me to the gas. I'm in Houston, and the gas is $2.09, and I drive to Cameron, and it's $2.35. What's going on, WTF? And that brings me to a close on the WTF moments, and we'll be back after this with an LTC attorney segment. Thank you. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's time for our LCT attorney segment. We're here with Rick Dodd, and we're talking about the private transfer and private sale of firearms without using a gun dealer. How you doing today, Rick?
I'm doing great today. By the way, my disease was cured. My dad had a leather strap hung on the window, and that was my big pharma medicine, so I don't suffer from ADHD anymore.
I probably didn't get enough of those as I got plenty, but I don't know that I got enough. And so
I was over at the stock show a while ago, and I see they're having the heifer sale, and it kind of reminded me back when you were a good-looking young man and sold me a goat over there. I think you won first place. So did you name those goats?
I conned you too, huh?
Did you name those goats?
No.
Oh, that's absolutely a good idea. You're never supposed to name what you're fixing to eat. By the way, right, it tasted right. Really good, Ross.
Well, I think, tell the folks how they can get in contact with you.
Oh, they can reach me at respectforyou.com. They can check out our website there. They can give us a call at 800-460-0606. We do quite a bit of asbestos work, so one of the websites is asbestoslaw.com, and call us at 888-MESO-FIRM. And so, by golly, we're here in Cameron, you know. I mean, how hard can it be? You just ask anybody.
That's right. And so I guess today we're talking about, though, specifically to the show, is the transfer of firearms. And so I think this is pretty important, you know, with the holidays coming up, with family members maybe transferring to them. You got friends and family, maybe you want to sell a gun to a nephew or a kid. So I think this is important for anybody listening that is thinking about selling or buying a firearm from somebody that they know that's not, a shop, academy, or a dealer. What is the first major thing we just need to know not to do?
Well, first off, we need to know that if we're going to sell firearms on some sort of regular basis, that we have to have a federal license. And to get that federal license or not to get that federal license becomes a question of whether or not you fit under certain categories. Now, the interesting part of that is that I had always thought that if you sold like more than 20 guns a year or 10 guns a year, that you had to get a license. But that's not true. The question really is whether you intend to make a profit, whether you do it on a regular business. In other words, if you inherit a bunch of guns, for instance, and you want to liquidate them, you might sell 300 or 400 guns in 1 year, but that doesn't require you to have a license. If you go to, say, some shows, gun shows, and you buy a few guns with the intention of going to the next gun show and sell them, even though it may be 4 or 5, and then you start doing that on a systematic basis, and you may only sell 10 or 15 a year, but that's a systematic basis of selling guns for a profit. That's when you need a license. Let me give you another example here. When you have someone who, say, has 3 or 4 guns at home and she no longer wants them, she goes ahead and sells a couple of them. She puts some advertisement in the newspaper and sells them. And then she figures out, hey, this is a pretty good idea. So then she buys a few off the newspaper and sells them. And pretty soon she has a card with her name on it. She needs a license. That's really all there is to it.
And so what about just the transfer? Let's say if I want to just, like you said, maybe I inherit a couple guns and I don't want them. Maybe I don't really go hunting very much anymore. I live in the city. Or maybe I want to sell some to my friend or my other family members who want to buy it from me. I don't need a license for that.
Well, there's a couple of codes, if you may. One of them is the 46.06 A and B that talk about that. There's also some U.S. codes. The thing about law, the codes, as you know, well know, being an attorney, and
that's right,
especially being a criminal attorney, is that they're not always black and white. You would think that the folks down in Austin would be able to write them such that everybody can look at them and understand exactly and precisely what they mean. But, you know, I guess words being somewhat limited, we're not able to do that. Plus, you got to remember that a bunch of those guys down there are lawyers, so they want to make sure that you and I have business, right? So so they make them a little bit complex. So say, for instance, you want to be sure that you know there's a difference between handguns and firearms.
And why is that?
Well, like, for instance, in Penal Code A1, 46.06A1, it talks about handguns with regard to things like, well, if you sell, rent, lease, loan, or give a handgun to anybody knowing that that person who you're giving it to intends to use it unlawfully or commit an unlawful act with it, then that's illegal.
And so basically the code section is talking about here that you cannot transfer a gun for an unlawful purpose. You cannot give a handgun to someone who you know is going to go out there and commit a crime. Now, it's funny to me why the statute says makes a distinction between handguns and firearms. I think that if you know that somebody's going to commit an offense and you give them the firearm, not the firearm, but any kind of firearm, handgun or firearm, if you give them that gun to go commit that offense, I think you're going to be probably guilty of aiding and abetting.
Yeah, and that gets into a gray area.
It does.
You know, that sort of flips into a different statute than firearm statute. It is aiding and abetting is, you know, kind of helping somebody out. If you know they're going to go commit a crime and you say, here, take this shotgun with you, then you're probably going to be convicted of the same crime that they're convicted of because they're treated pretty much the same.
Okay, so what about maybe, let's talk about if you want to, what about a father? Can he give his 16-year-old son a deer rifle for Christmas?
Sure, he can. The thing about transferring firearms to a minor, if you're going to transfer a firearm to someone who's under, say, 18 years old, you can do that by getting parental consent or a guardian. A guardian or parent can give consent for their under 18-year-old person to get a firearm. So if you're going to give it to someone like that, you need to make sure that they have consent. If you're going to sell it to someone or loan it to them, you need to make sure that that person has consent. Otherwise, you will yourself have committed a crime.
When you say consent, is there ever a difference between written consent and verbal consent?
Well,
or do you just
only
need the consent?
Only if someone is accused of lying.
And
so if you have it written, then nobody's going to lie about it, right?
Okay, so let's say that my sister and I aren't really getting along, but I love my nephew, and so I want to sell him a gun, or, you know, I want to sell my dad's shotgun to my 14-year-old nephew. And so as long as if I called my sister and asked her if that would be okay, is that necessarily going to keep me absolutely protected?
No, and the words necessarily and absolutely are where you get me on that. You know, your sister, if she hates you, she could turn around then and lie, like I just suggested, and say, oh, no, I never told him he could do that. And here you have a child who is under 17 years old that you're talking about, which that gets us into another category.
And so, folks, directly on point here is that if you give a firearm to a minor, okay, and it's a gift, then all you've got to have is the parent's verbal consent. The parent can say that they gave you consent. But if you sell a firearm to a minor, you actually have to have written consent. You have to have written parental consent or of the custodian in order to sell that firearm. And that's important because you need to have proof that they gave the consent. And so, yes, I understand that family members get along, but I can tell you that in my business doing family law, estate planning, right, and probate, in criminal law, family members lie all the time. And so we're not necessarily thinking that they're actually going to lie to come after you. But what if something happens to that child and they're just trying to protect their own self? And they may put the blame on you. I didn't know he had that gun. I didn't give him that gun. I don't know where he got that gun. And then it's going to come back on you. And so I would say that the safest thing to do in every situation when you're selling to a minor is to get the consent of the custodian or the parent in writing.
Yeah, because it's illegal. It's a crime if you make available a readily dischargeable firearm, and it can be loaded. It doesn't necessarily have to have one in the chamber, but it's loaded. And if the person, and they call it negligently, failed to secure it, well, I'm not sure what they mean by negligently. Maybe they just flat out failed on purpose to secure it. And if that child less than 17 years old gets a hold of it and hurts somebody with it, either himself or somebody else, then you've committed a crime. I actually, as a civil trial lawyer, I had a case like that before where the grandfather had shown a 14-year-old a pistol and said, I'm going to give this to you when you get older. And then, you know, put it away while the child's watching him. And sure enough, when grandfather went off to the grocery store, the kid got it out and was playing with it and shot his buddy in the stomach. Fortunately for the young man who got shot, he went to the emergency room quickly and they fixed him up. And 6 months later, he was throwing the shot put. and it was a .22 caliber, but nonetheless, it was an offense.
Which have a tendency to go anywhere after they hit you, too, and so
that's
true. Dangerous.
Yeah, it was really dangerous. It pierced some of the small intestines, and the doctors are able to put those together, amazingly enough, so that they don't come apart again, and there's really no long-term problems.
I think we got Matt Beatros online here. What's going on, Matt?
Dude, you sound awesome. You really sound good.
Too gracious.
I had a break, and I told you I was going to call in to say hi. I just want to thank you guys for, you know, taking over and marching on while I'm out here doing some serious training with some local churches, and we're having a great time. But you're doing an awesome job, and I just want to tell you thank you for squaring me away there. And Trey, thank you. Rick, thank you. And have a great time on the show. And everybody, you know, these guys got it going on. So
hey Matt,
take notes.
Matt, I got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
If someone wants to sell one of their private guns to someone else, would your company, your business, be willing to facilitate that for a small fee?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of times it happens without a person like me at FFL in the process, but it's always a better idea because what happens technically when the person comes in and I sign it into my books, in reality, the gun is now mine. I own it. And then when I sign it back out, it goes to the person who signs the 4473. So the person who sold the gun has a nice paper trail and is released to the liability of the firearm.
Absolutely. And Matt, after we explain some of these laws to our listeners, I think bottom line is I'm going to recommend that they do that to fully protect themselves.
Well, I concur with that. That's always the best way to do it. Sometimes it's not possible. And if it's not possible, I was thinking alternative methods like getting a bill of sale with a signature, a social number, something that shows that, hey, at this particular date, I gave up possession of the weapon.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are some other issues that we're going to bring up, Ross and I, so you might want to listen to them, Matt.
I would love to, and I'm going to listen to the replay, but we're getting back to some serious training here. And hopefully, you know, if everybody out there wants some extra training, give us a call. Go to the website, aaronsgunshop.com, and give me an email at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com, and I'll respond back to you. But otherwise, I want to let you guys get back at it. You're doing awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, bye-bye.
And so, I mean, we've covered minors. And he's right, and that's what I'm saying. Anytime you're going to sell the farm, you need to get it in writing. It doesn't really matter. But I'm telling you, as far as minors, it will be a crime. It will be the crime will have been committed if you do not get it in writing and it's a sale. Okay, and so you're liable at that point.
And I want to make another point that has to do with clubs or
knives. Yeah,
knives,
exactly.
Firearms. But what else is important is that it becomes a felony if it's a handgun.
Yes.
So they do make a distinction
Absolutely.
Between the long gun and the short guns here.
And that's
minors.
Important to point out. If you're selling the handgun to a child and you don't get it in writing, at the point that the transfer is done, you've committed a felony, regardless whether the parent tells the police that they gave verbal consent. There's got to be written consent. Okay, and so
now the part about the making of a firearm available to a child less than 17, that is either a handgun or a long gun. It doesn't matter. So there's a couple other things you need to be aware of. You need to make sure that the person is of sound mind. Now, if you sell or otherwise dispose of a firearm knowing or having reasonable belief that such person has been adjudicated as a mental defective or been committed for any kind of a mental institution, then that's a criminal act. So that's something else you got to be careful about.
And that's kind of, so let's talk, what if I'm involuntarily insane? For instance, if I've had way too much to drink at Worst Fest. Okay, and or let's say that, you know, every Thanksgiving my cousin and I like to go down to the tank and drink a bunch of beer and shoot snakes. I'm not saying that was always the best decision, but that's what we did. And so a lot of times I'd have too much, or maybe I'm just a bad shot, and I'd run out of ammo, and I'd say, hey man, can I pay you for my, you know, for some extra shells? In your opinion, would that transfer be legal?
Well, now you bring up ammunition, so the answer to that would be, it depends on whether you're intoxicated or not. Now, you know, we see it all the time where people say, well, if you drink and drive, you've committed a crime. Well, no, if you're if you're driving while your means of
lost the use of your mental or physical faculties.
Yeah, loss of that, then that's crime. So just drinking is not enough. But if you're intoxicated, now there is a little bit of difference, Ross, between driving while intoxicated and intoxicated with regard to, you know, selling or buying ammunition or firearms. And since you do a lot of criminal law, can you maybe share with me what that difference is? Because I didn't really understand it.
That's right. So like intoxicated as far as DWI means the loss of the use of your mental or physical faculties. And so it's got to be the police officer, or it's presumed if you've got a blood test or a breath test. But for purposes of the transfer, it says a substantial impairment of mental or physical capacity. And as you know, substantial means basically whatever the eye of the beholder is.
Amen.
And so you're opening yourself up for it to be substantial if there's alcohol or any kind of substance involved in any way. And so you cannot sell firearms or ammunition to some recklessly, and it's not even knowingly. And so this could be an accident from your standpoint if you had some evidence maybe that there was alcohol or some kind of substance involved. And you sell that firearm or ammunition, then you can get in trouble, and that would be a Class A misdemeanor. It may not happen. It may be more practical for like Academy and other places like that, but I thought it was a fun and at least maybe a somewhat of a good tip to know. And I think we all know about transferring to a felons. I just want to point out you really should check to see, do a background check or things like that. It's another reason to go through, Matt. And it's not just on the state level. It's on the federal level. And
I got a question about that.
Yeah.
You know, on the state level, it says that you've committed a crime if you knowingly sell a firearm or ammunition or to a person who's been convicted of felony. And then it goes on, talks about some people who've been out on supervision, parole. But then that's the state law. It says knowingly sell. But the U.S. code says it shall be unlawful for any person to sell or otherwise dispose. And then it goes on, knowing or having reasonable cause to believe that such person is under indictment or convicted. It seems like in Texas, looks like when you read this, that, you know I'm selling the gun to somebody. Now, I may not know and may not have any reasonable belief to believe that that person is a felon. But it looks like if I know I'm selling a felon a gun, even though I don't know they're a felon, that I've committed a crime.
You're about to open up Pandora's box, so I want to say one thing on this. I'm going to answer your question, but I want to get this out because this is going to take us into a whole new subject. And it is, if you are going to sell a firearm to a felon, and that could be a family member. You think this doesn't apply to you, but you got a family member. Oh, he's doing better. You know, Rick's out on probation, you know, and he just got off probation, doing great, you know, and he wants to go hunting next year. So if you want to sell it, make sure that it must be the fifth anniversary of the later of either one of these, the release from confinement or their release from community supervision, their probation. So it's either they've got to be off probation for 5 years or they have to have been out of jail for 5 years. If it's within that time period, you're going to be in trouble for selling them or transferring that firearm. Okay, selling a firearm or ammunition. And it's going to be hard to say you didn't know, obviously, if you're a family member.
Well, Ross, I'm a little confused. I thought a felon could not possess a firearm.
That's true.
So how would
But you're going to be in trouble for being the one to sell him that firearm.
Okay. Well, he's going to be in trouble either way then, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
So in to answer your question, that goes into, on the federal level, right, the standard of proof and what they can show as far as knowing, on the federal level, it's the reasonable cause to believe, okay? And so this was a problem when we're talking about illegal foreign nationals. And back in 2010, there was a good case of a guy who sold a firearm to somebody that walked into a gun show, and the guy had a valid driver's license. And the ATF and the feds were there to do a sting operation, and they happened to see this transfer go down, and they ended up arresting this gentleman for not because he had reasonable cause to believe that it was an illegal foreign national. And so they go to trial and they said, well, the guy was Mexican, he wore cowboy boots, and he spoke Spanish. You had reasonable cause to believe that he was an illegal foreign national. In my opinion, that's racist, right? There's problems with that. I don't agree with that at all. It's all over the internet. You can pull it up. You can Google illegal foreign national transfer firearm in Texas.
Now, was he arrested or convicted?
He was. He was tried and convicted.
Convicted for that?
Actually, yes.
That convicted. Sounds like it's an unconstitutional situation to me.
And so, and at that point in time, this is why everybody's getting so strict about doing the background checks and making sure that people are sign off on things like Matt's saying in a bill of sale. Because if you don't do these things, they can use any kind of evidence at all whatsoever to say you had reasonable cause to believe. And reasonable is another one of those eye of the beholder words, like yeah. substantial.
Well, getting back to this five-year thing you were talking about, you know, everybody's got some black sheeps in their family. So let's say
I'm one of them.
Let's say Cousin Benny shows up at the family reunion, and I know that he's been out of prison for 10 years.
But maybe you didn't know he had another condition, and when he got out, he stayed on probation.
Well, he would be an ex-felon. We know that, right?
We know that.
Okay, so all this other stuff you just talked about, let's say that I go ahead and sell Benny my 9mm. Wouldn't I be aiding and abetting him, since I know that it's a
to
crime
commit
for
that
him
crime?
To have the 9mm?
If you thought that he was off for the length of period, but then yes, you go back to because felon in possession of a firearm is a felony. And so then if you're going to sell to a person for the purpose of committing an unlawful act, then that is a crime in and of itself. And here's the kicker. You're going to be aiding and abetting, so you can be charged with felon in possession of a firearm, and right, you're going to be in trouble for transfer of a weapon for an unlawful purpose.
Yeah, okay.
And so don't do it.
Don't do it. So
I know he's begging you to do it, and he's saying, man, I changed, but don't do it, okay? Tell him to go buy it from Matt.
So that brings us back to the whole idea that if you do want to get rid of your personal guns, to go to a licensed gun dealer who generally for a small fee will do that for you. You're talking about the foreign nationals. You got to be careful with people who have dishonorable discharges or somebody who has renounced their citizenship. I don't know anybody who's renounced their citizenship, but that's just one of the things thrown in there.
The dishonorable discharge was one that I had forgotten about. I throw it out there. And how are you going to know? How are you going to know that?
Well, if you know, again, in Texas, it says knowingly sell. The U.S. Code says if you have reasonable belief. So I would say you wouldn't be breaking the law, the federal law, but you might be breaking the Texas law if you don't really check it out. There's also stuff about, you know, if you sell your gun to somebody else, shipping it across state lines, you have to be careful about that. I think the best idea is definitely go to a gun dealer who can ship it, or at least have it received by a gun dealer.
And I'll cover briefly, because we're almost getting to the point where we want to talk about what maybe you should do if you try to structure your own bill of sale. We didn't cover protective orders. It is illegal to sell, rent, lease, loan, or give a handgun to a person knowing that an active protective order is directed to the person to whom the handgun is to be delivered. So, again,
it doesn't matter if that protective order is for you or for your cousin. It's just illegal to do it if there's a protective order out there, period.
But, this is so specific that it probably only applies to lawyers who are in the business. But maybe if somebody's listening that happens so to be under a protective order, it does not apply to a temporary protective order. And that would happen, like, let's say that you get falsely accused of some kind of domestic assault. They're going to issue a temporary protective order right off the bat, no matter what happens. Okay. And that thing may stay in effect, you know, 30 to 90 days. And there may not have been a hearing because it could have been continued or anything like that. And then the case ends up getting dismissed. There's supposed to be a hearing sooner than that, but it does happen.
10 days, right?
Yes, yes. But it does happen where it gets continued. And I've seen it, and it's been strategy from my side to try to drag that out and to try to get my client out of trouble before any other consequences happen. And so if it's just a temporary protective order, and this may not apply, it does not apply to this rule.
Yeah, a lot of times the client will wait till 9.5 days before they open the door to your office, right?
That's right. That's typical.
So, we got a hearing at 9:00 in the morning. Ross, right. Can you help me out?
It's kind of like Matt telling me to make an opinion piece 24 hours before the show. I'm probably exaggerating, but, you know, I got ADHD, so I digress. So back to the bill of sale. If we didn't go to Matt, what are some things maybe we should try to put in that bill of sale?
Well, we ought to go to Matt. But if we're going to do it ourselves, we want to get a bill of sale where the person who's buying it pretty much says that he's never been convicted of a crime that's punishable by imprisonment to exceed a year. Remember, we have heard a lot about that in the news lately, about the fellow who in military court had been convicted of a crime that he could have been punished for more than a year, but it never got put on the national database. So you want to get them to say that they've never been convicted, that they're not a fugitive of justice, that they're not an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance. I think we missed that one a little while ago.
Which would apply to the intoxication stuff too, yeah.
Well,
if they're not a
someone's
user
not
of,
intoxicated,
that's right,
but
that's right.
You know that
You're
they're
right.
addicted.
That's a federal offense.
Yeah. has never been adjudicated of any kind of a mental disease. We talked about that a little while ago. Is not an illegal alien or unlawfully in the United States. Has not been discharged with a dishonorable discharge. Has never renounced their citizenship. Again, I don't know anybody that's ever done that, but hey, you know, I guess they're out there. Is not subject to the court order you just talked about, the restraining order, and has not been convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. That's one we missed a little while ago. And cannot lawfully receive, possess, or ship or transfer a firearm. You know, that's kind of a, one of those catch-all things. It's not a person under indictment. So, you know, you want to tell them, and I know this sounds silly, but they've got to sign an affidavit saying they don't intend to use it while they're intoxicated, and that they don't intend to use it for any illegal offense, and that they are not legally prohibited from buying, receiving, or possessing firearms. In other words, that felony thing I talked about. And I think basically it's kind of tough to get somebody to swear that they're of sound mind, but you know, if you have that in there, it's kind of like asking someone who's been
Purple elephants, Judge. Purple elephants.
That's right.
And so, you know, it's hard to cover everything, every single illegal transfer law in the segment that we have. And so we encourage you, if you have questions or you're going to do it, don't do it yourself. Go to a professional like Matt. If you want to come by my office, if you got some questions, feel free to do that. I'm at 105 East Main Street in Cameron. I'm across from the courthouse. You can call my office at 254-605-4140 or Benton@Watson.legal, or go to Rick's office and you can contact him over at Capolino.Krebs. And if you got anything else to tell folks before we get out of here.
Well, we don't want to make you paranoid about this, because if you've got a 14-year-old nephew and you're in good terms with your sister and all that works out, just give the gun to him, take him hunting. That's what needs to be done. You know, I don't kill as many deer as I used to, but I still hunt a whole lot because I hunt with a bow and arrow now. So it's always good to take the kid out.
All right. Well, thanks, Rick. We appreciate you having me on, man.
All right. It's good to be here.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, with the topic of interest. Matt left me some things to talk about, but I do want to say a little bit about where he is today. You know, with all the church shootings and things going on, he got a pretty big group coming in. There was a lot of people. He's doing some good work for the church interest and helping those people out learn how to protect themselves. I want to make sure to tell you, if you think that your church may be in that situation, maybe a candidate for that, we encourage you to give him a call. You can contact him too at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com. It's aaronsgunshop@gmail.com, or check out their Facebook page at Aaron's Gunshop Facebook page, or go to their website, aaronsgunshop.com. But of the topic of interest, last night was ladies' night. More and more women are showing up, and that's great. The ladies get in free at the range every third Friday of the month. He says, bring whoever you want, whatever gender, bring a woman the third Friday of the month, and their range time is free. The LTC classes on the 25th is full. If you have groups of five or more, you can set up your own class with Aaron's and coordinate a date that works both for the group and Aaron's. Men's student are $60. New students are $60. Refresher students are $40. On December 2nd is Aaron's co-ed self-defense and home invasion seminar. Go to aaronsgunshop.com, high cap adventure page, to see the details of this course. Any church groups out there need training, he can modify the course to suit your needs as appropriate, right, under your circumstances. December 8th will be this year's round robin competition. Matt is trying to find a cool prize for the winner, so stand by for that. He'll probably let us know when he comes back on. Be sure to check out the aaronsgunshop.com to see what they have in store. Like them on Facebook, Aaron's Gunshop YouTube channel. Become a subscriber. There's lots of great training videos, products, demos, and breakdowns and explanation of laws pertaining to LTC.
It is now time for the master of manners, the communicator of common sense, and the epitome of encyclopedia, Officer Randy Dixon, the voice of law enforcement.
Good morning, everyone. It's a Saturday. Just think, only one less than a week away from Thanksgiving, and then we have that wonderful Friday, and I won't call it because, you know, every lives matter. But coming up after Thanksgiving, the shoppers are going to be out. The people will be taking all the everything but common sense. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to talk a little bit about where are you going to go on Thanksgiving? You know, used to be people would think that Christmas was the heaviest traveled day of the year. Well, that's been replaced. About 15, 20 years ago, everyone discovered that Thanksgiving is the heaviest traveled holiday of all of our holidays. And why is that? Well, everybody wants to stay home and see Santa Claus come down that chimney for their kids, but you want to go see Grandma through the dale and over the woods when it's Thanksgiving. So today what I want to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about what do you do when you're traveling. You know, everybody has a way and a place they go when they during the holidays, but how you get there is very, very important. I know that many times I've had friends and relatives who've taken off to go maybe skiing during that weekend up in Colorado, or maybe they decide to go over to visit someone in another state or up north or down south. But every one of them has some point has had some kind of incident that's happened that has maybe put a little bit of a question mark on did they prepare correctly for it. I'm not going to say everybody's going to have problems, because problems are something that's a different light, different story altogether. But when you travel, you need to do some things. You need to take some considerations. You know, millions of people are expected to travel over the upcoming weekend. You know, they estimate that there are going to be 42.5 million Americans on the road that's going to be going 50 miles or more away from their house this coming Thursday night, or this coming Wednesday night, and returning on Sunday. If you've ever driven down I-35 on a holiday weekend, especially with construction, you know it's bumper to bumper, hour and a half just to get through the construction zone. But you know, before you embark, you need to consider some tips to help prepare you and your car for whatever challenges that might be ahead on the road. The first thing you need to do is make sure, and I'm telling you, even though prices are going up, we still have the lowest prices of all the civilized world, you need to make sure your car is filled up with gasoline. Can't tell you how many times along the side of the road you see people that are pulled over, broke down. Most of the time, they're out of gas. You know, it might be the sign that says, last fill up for 200 miles, but in most cases, that's not the case. Keep your gas tank full. Make sure your car's in good condition for that road trip. You know, if you see that you're going to get down below a half a tank or so and you're heading out to West Texas, you might get that gas, even though it's a dime higher at that station than a Sam's somewhere. Keep your car full. Be prepared. And, you know, everybody has their own idea about what be prepared means. But bring supplies in the event of an accident or a medical issue. You know, stock your car with an emergency kit. And people say, oh, I don't need that. Yeah, you do, folks. You know, we've got weather changes. We've got things that happen across this country. It's supposed to be a cool front coming in on the Thanksgiving weekend. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be snowing or freezing rain. But cars change. Your car batteries drain. Your car sometimes overheats in certain areas. Have an emergency kit, especially a flashlight, a blanket, and maybe a first aid kit with you. And, you know, it has some basic tools. Most things we can do with just some basic tools. You pop a hose off, or if your belt comes off, have at least something that you can remedy that with, fix it with. And of all, make sure you have the best mechanic tool there are in your tent, and that's duct tape. Put a roll of good duct tape in your car, if it's Gorilla Tape or something. And if you have to, you can tape up a hose and maybe make it to the next town so that you can fill it up. Put a couple of gallons of water in the back of your car. You know, I think water is, 7.5 pounds a gallon. Put your 2 gallons back there, maybe a gallon of antifreeze. And in case something does happen, you'll have something to help you with. You know, you're going to be sharing the road with a lot of people. Number one, you need to have a little bit of patience. You also need to understand that you need to keep every one of your fingers tucked into your hand when people are getting a little aggravated at you. That number one salute only makes number of people get madder and makes people a little bit on the hostile side towards you. Road rage is something that is not cool during the holidays, even though it's something that happens every single day. You know, you also need to do, and this is something that's extremely important, you need to make sure that you share your travel plans with someone you know. You know, hypothetically, let's say that I decide to take off to Boise, Idaho. So I'm going to get in my car, my truck, pack my things up, put my chains in back because I know I'm going to be going over some mountain passes. Put me some water, put my first aid kit in there, my food supply kit, and I'm going to take off for the mountains of Idaho. But, you know, I need to let somebody know where I'm going, you know, because accidents do happen. And sometimes accidents happen to such a degree that people don't know where you're at and you can't respond. You may be in the hospital or even worse. So plan an itinerary. And I know we don't like people knowing our business, but tell someone. Give them a route you're going to take. Give them some information on how you're going to get there. You know, as we get up in years, we start missing. Somebody's going to put a silver alert out on us, and we don't want that. Also, I don't know how many of you watch the Weather Channel. I'm one of those persons that is addicted to the Weather Channel. But check the weather along your route and plan for travel around any storms that may be coming. If you're going to head toward the west or head toward the mountains, please take the time to check what the weather forecast is going to be. I know that last night I was looking at the weather maps, and if I decided I was going to be going up into the mountains, I don't know how many of you know where Monarch Pass, Colorado is, but they were expecting 3.5 feet of snow along the pass last night. Well, that's a lot of snow, folks. Whiteout conditions. Or if you're going up into the Midwest, they're expecting some very heavy storms with this passing of this cool front coming in. Take the time to check your weather. You need to be well rested and alerted. I don't know about you all, but when I had smaller children, one of the ways we used to take vacations is we'd leave about 9 o'clock at night, hoping that the kids would fall asleep and be asleep all the way through as we got there and get there the next morning. Well, that's great, except for one thing. We're dead when you're driving. You know, we've been up all day packing, getting things ready, haven't slept, and you're going to drive all night. That's not a cool thing. A 5-hour power, a shot of coffee, that just doesn't do it sometimes. So you do need to be well rested. You need to be prepared for that. You also need to pack smart. And when you say that, what do you mean pack smart? Well, folks, you know, every car has a capacity, and every car has a load capacity. Pickups have load capacities. On most new cars, the total weight you can carry is printed out on a placard or a sticker that's beside the driver's door. You know, putting 10,000 pounds of luggage in your back, not that anybody would pack that much, but if you put 10,000 pounds of luggage in the car, and then you've got 3 or 4 adults and 2 or 3 kids stuffed in the car, you now have made that car inefficient. You've also made it very dangerous. It's passing the load rating. You're not going to be able to stop. You're not going to be able to slow down. Now, let's say that we're going to go somewhere. We've made our list. We've packed it twice. We've checked who's not. No, it's a different story. We packed everything up, and we're ready to go. Well, where are we going? How are we going to get there? Well, the important thing to do is nowadays try to avoid any back roads. And you say, well, why would we want to avoid back roads? Well, it's real simple. If you break down, you're not going to have a whole lot of people to help you, and you're not going to have a whole lot of amenities to be able to find a place for help. Get you a good GPS if your phone does not have a built-in GPS, and plot your trip ahead of time. Use a little common sense. Use a little planning. Plan what to do. As a navigator, you can help, you know, put your wife next door. Of course, they usually can read maps a lot better because they'll actually stop and ask for directions, where us men simply say, I know where I'm going. I know where I'm going. Well, let your wife go ask where we need to go, or your girlfriend. A navigator can help direct you through emergency services and things of that nature. If you have an OnStar, use it. Don't be afraid to use it. And there's another thing. Every cell phone, I don't care whether it's one that's activated for service or not, but every cell phone, by law, must allow to be used 911. So even if you don't have cell phone service for a phone, take it along, put it in the car. That way, if someone is injured and you can't get to your phone, possibly they could use it to call 911. It'll help locate where they're at as well. Also, you need to kid prepare. And you say, kid prepare? What is that? Well, that doesn't mean you put them in straight jackets and tape their mouth shut or anything like that. That's illegal. But if you're driving with kids, make sure you pack enough snacks, warm water, games, a video, whatever it is that keeps their attention. There's nothing worse than having a tension-filled trip where you've got traffic everywhere and kids in the back seat that are totally out of control. It makes your nerves short, their nerves short, and when two nerves are short together, it doesn't make one long nerve, it just makes one long pain in the you-know-what. With new modern phones, most kids stay active. Most kids can stay busy with their phones. But you have smaller kids, that's a different story. Had an opportunity to be involved in a case just a couple of days ago for a part-time job I've got, where there was a young lady that was turning into a driveway, and she had her children in the back seat of a car, in a car seat, and a vehicle slammed in the back of them going well over the speed limit. There were injuries involved, but the important thing I'm trying to make is those kids were totally, they were scared, they were crying, they were injured, and the mother became frantic. Know where you're going to go, know how to have an escape route. If you need to have an escape route. And I'm not even going to cover travel with pets, but if you do have a pet and you're going to travel with them, let them have a potty break once in a while. They're just like humans. They need to go once. And be patient. If there's nothing else you get out of what I have to say today, do me a favor. Be patient. During busy travel times, expect to hit traffic delays. It may make sense to drive late at night or early in the morning, whichever you want to do to avoid and ensure the rush hours. You know, a GPS, especially the modern GPSs, especially the ones that are on your iPhones or Androids, they're going to light up and they're going to show you where heavy traffic is. I had to go to Waco just here recently, had my GPS going because I didn't know where I was going in Waco. And from just outside of Troy all the way to just this side of Waco, it was solid red. What did that tell me to do? That told me to go on a side road. It told me to go take an alternate route. If you don't, you're going to be sitting there hours at a time trying to entertain yourself, your kids, and trying to keep yourself sane during that slowdown. Secondly, don't be distracted. We know in Texas it's against the law to text while you drive. But have you seen lately how many people are still texting and driving? It's an inordinate amount. Nobody's paying attention to that, and some areas aren't enforcing it anyway. Put your cell phone down. It's not a time to text. It's not a time to do something that's during your holiday travels. You want to come back. You want to see your family. You want to see grandma. You want to see mom and dad. Texting and driving can keep that from happening, folks. If you got a text, if you just have to talk to someone, if you got a Facebook, you got an Instagram, pull that cotton picking car over, stop it, and then do it. It's not worth risking your life or others on the road just to keep social media involved. You can do that when you get there, folks. Buckle up. Always use your seatbelt. Make sure your kids are properly secured as well. You know, if they're in the rear seats, they got to have seatbelts on. Keep them tight. Keep them pulled down. Keep them cinched in. You know, and, you know, the best thing I can tell you through this whole or the whole idea of what we're talking about today is please keep in control. There could be a variety of scenarios on the road, but if you stay calm and be prepared, you can get through almost any challenge. You know, sometimes we wonder about how we're going to survive the trip somewhere. Maybe our car overheats. Maybe we have a blowout of a tire. And I'm not a big advocate of anybody having to spend extra money. But folks, I'm telling you, spend that $100 a year and get into AAA, have a good AAA card or some other card. AAA is the most universally accepted. Have you some kind of road service that if you do break down along the highway, you're going to have some help. This is especially true if you're older and you need help, or if you're young and have children, or if you're a single woman, or even a single father taking children somewhere. You got to take a little bit of common sense and a little bit of attitude with you when you travel. The best attitude is to stay in a good attitude. You know, only drivers, especially big rig drivers who are considered professional drivers, they understand that you have to stop every once in a while. You'll see trucks pulled over to the side of the road. The driver is just out walking around or doing other things on the side of the truck. Or maybe he had pulled over and slept for a few hours. Don't push it. Take a break once in a while. Walk around your car. Stretch your legs. From a safety standpoint, number one, it's better for you. But secondly, it's better for your mental capabilities to drive and operate a vehicle. And a couple of quick things, too. If you have car trouble, pull your car as far over to the right as possible. Try to get it off the main traveled portion of the roadway. Get your flashers on. Get your hood up. If you have some type of a red flag or a white flag, tie it to an antenna if you have an antenna. But don't go walking. It doesn't pay to start out searching for help. You go out searching for help, you're going to find some help you don't want to have. You know, you may have a trucker that's going to stop and help you, or he may give you a lift or something. Dangerous to start with. Hitchhiking is even more dangerous. But if you have a whole band of motorcycles stop and they look like they're fixing to come out of a Rocky Horror show, you might not want to open your window for them. Keep the window up. Get on your phone. Call 911 and get some help. You know, last but not least, try to have a great, great vacation. A great time going to grandma's. But folks, you got to have a little bit of common sense. Take you a pillow. Take you some luggage that has some first aid kits in it. Take you some blankets, because you never, ever know what's going to happen when you're on a trip. The worst could happen, or it could be uneventful. We pray for uneventful, but there's times when that's not going to happen. So one of the things I want to wish y'all to do is I want you to have a great Thanksgiving. But you got to have common sense when you have Thanksgiving, or at Christmas, or any other time of the year. You've got to use common sense and make that common sense see you through even the worst of times. And let's make this the best of times. So, folks, just a couple of last things. Pray for our Dallas Cowboys because it's not going to be pretty the next 5 weeks. And try to be the best. Have a good family time. Tell your family you love them because you're never guaranteed another Thanksgiving after this one. Be safe. Be careful, everybody. And a happy Thanksgiving.
We're back on the show now. We got the with the product spotlight. We got a special interview after that with John Reddington. And so with no further ado, let's get started. Today, the product spotlight's on the Glock 21 and 21SF and the 45 caliber ACP and the Advantage Arms 22 conversion kit that goes on it. These two products are sponsored by ANC Firearms in Heidenheimer. Arch Kuntz is the owner. Go down there and see staff Clint, Mike, and Dennis. They've got pistols, rifles, shotguns, ammos, knives, accessories, reloading equipment. Call them at 254-983-4417. Look at the pictures on the Aaron's Gun Shop Facebook page. Go and look at the special combo that we're going to talk about. That's at AC Firearms. They've got an exclusive deal. It's the combo package with the Glock 21SF, the Gen 3 with Advantage Arms conversion kit, only $765. Folks, the regular price was $859.99. That's almost $100 in savings. So call ANC Firearms now at 254-983-4417. Or better yet, go down there and get some of this deal. What we're going to talk about, and after we talk about this, maybe you'll be more interested in it. We're talking about the best bug-out handgun, and we're going to compare two guns, the Glock 21 and 21SF. The Model 21, Glock's full-size 45 caliber handgun, makes an outstanding handgun for your bug-out bag, you know, when stuff gets bad and you got to bug out. Okay, and the second gun, the Glock 21SF, is actually an incredibly a brilliant improvement on this gun. Now, after looking at this article and the differences, you may think both are your favorite gun. So let's look at some of these features. We all know Glocks have nylon-based polymer frame, a magazine body which is lighter and less brittle than a steel frame through a wide range of temperatures. The barrel and slide are treated with the Tannifer process. Folks, that's Glock's proprietary ferritic nitrocarburizing method, which results in greater hardness and corrosion resistance than stainless steel. Tannifer steel is dull gray, so Glock parkerizes or phosphatizes it. They got a chemical conversion process that gives the gun the black cool finish that you always see. Even if this finish wears off, say by your holster wear on your Glock 23 concealed carry favorite, the gun retains all of the benefits of the Tannifer process. Now, some people don't mind the little wear because it just gives it character, like the great mahogany floors of those ancient courtrooms or the chestnut handrails on the century-old staircase on a European castle. So from a practical standpoint, however, the corrosion resistance alone makes any Glock a good candidate for any bug out bag or a bug out gun. But you all know, life gets hectic. And you should check your bug out bag, every month or so. But then you got spring and you got baseball, gardening, ballet lessons and lots of traveling. Then it's the summer fun. And then it's, back in the holidays. And, before you know it, you haven't dusted and you haven't checked anything. And we know that the bags get neglected. And if any moisture develops from temperature or humidity changes, metallic items in the bag start to rust. Unless they are corrosion resistant, just like the Glocks. Yes, clothes can mildew and that's not going to kill you. But a rusty gun might put your life at risk. So another good feature that the Glocks have is a safe action trigger. Glocks don't have a manual safety. That is, you can't throw the lever and disable the trigger. But they do have three independent safety mechanisms. One is an external integrated safety which prevents accidental activation of the trigger. This consists of a lever on the trigger that must be depressed in order to operate it. Because this lever is depressed only by direct backward pressure on the trigger, it prevents almost any accidental trigger operation unless it is deliberate. The other two safeties are internal. One is a firing pin that blocks the firing pin unless the trigger is depressed. The other is a drop safety that releases the trigger bar only as the trigger is depressed, which theoretically, although we don't recommend it, theoretically, if you drop the gun, it's not supposed to discharge. Comparing the two guns, one of the common complaints of the 21 is that the grip is too large. Glock addressed this in the SF model, which stands for short frame, not slim frame, but short frame. The grip is the same thickness in both guns, but they shorten the distance between the back strap and the trigger, which decreased the circumference in the grip without changing its thickness. New to the 21SF is an optional ambidextrous magazine release and Picatinny rail instead of the standard universal Glock rail for accessories like lights and lasers. Magazines from the original 21 will not work with the Ambi Option 21SF. You have to get mags specifically made for the 21SF. Some people say that they work, but Matt and other experts agree that that's not their experience. Mags for the 21 SF, however, will work in both guns. These mags are distinguished by a small metal plate on their front. Some variants of the 21 SF come without the ambi mag release or the Picatinny rail, and so are visually difficult to distinguish from the regular 21, except, of course, for the SF stamped into the right side of the frame just behind the accessory rail. One nice improvement also is a two-stage recoil spring like the one in the baby Glocks. I think Matt said he's got a 21 SF that includes a factory tritium night sights and from the Advantage Arms 22 conversion for the 21, which we're going to talk about here in a second. So out of these, which one is recommended? The 21 and specifically the 21 SF. Matt said he's got whittle hands. And so a lot of times if that's true, the 21 SF is better. I wonder if he's got Vianney sausages or whittle hands. And so, but from the other standpoint, any Glock, the characteristics are great because of the corrosion and the caliber. You know, you may not be fanatical about survival and things like that, but if you get into an Armageddon situation, you want the 45. And so the Glock 21 SF fits the bill and match whittle hands. The other product we're looking at is this Advantage Arms LE22 conversion kit to be used on the following Glock models, the 20, the 20 SF, the 21, and the 21 SF, but it will not work, however, on the Gen 4. Now, Matt got especially excited about this. He wanted me to point out that he uses the Senior conversion kits, and they work great. They work fine, but he says that this one smokes them, blows them out of the water without spending a lot of money. So listen up. It also comes with a one-year factory direct warranty through Advantage Arms. The warranty covers any defects in materials or workmanship. Exclusive features of the kit are, one, adjustable sights. The front and rear sights are removable Glock OEM sights. The rear sight is adjustable for both wind and elevation. Last round lock open. The slide will lock open after the last round and the magazine is fired. Are you the Advantage Arms unique patented magazine design and heat treated steel lock open inserts. It allows them to offer this special and desirable feature, which you can find only on Advantage Arms 22LR Glock conversions. The third feature is the internal and firing pin safety. That means the Glock, we all know, incorporated an internal firing pin safety into their guns we talked about. But Advantage Arms thought it was important enough to include in its own conversion kits as well. Their internal firing pin safety designed to eliminate accidental discharges from dropping the firearm. And the fourth is the finish. All aluminum parts anodized per mil A8625 with a matte black finish. All steel parts are heat treated with a black oxide finish. The barrel is made from heat treated 416 stainless steel. The 10-second installation, which means installation is simple and does not require modifications to your Glock. Simply remove the Glock from the magazine and slide as outlined in the Glock's owner manual. Now slide the Advantage arm slide onto the frame until it engages the slide lock. Check to make sure the slide lock is in its most upward position. Insert the magazine and yes, you're ready to fire. This procedure can be accomplished in 10 seconds with some practice. Advantage Arms conversion kits, you should know, and their associated magazines are in very high demand. Their high demand items do extremely limited production. Advantage Arms products are rarely, if ever, in stock. That means back order times for the conversion kits can be months, but you can go down to ANC Firearms and get one today. Do not use, Matt wanted me to make sure to point out, do not use Stinger or any other hypervelocity ammo. Do not use Remington Thunderbolts. And folks, I didn't know Matt knew words this big, but he talks about efficacy here. He says, over the years, the CCI 40 grain round nose mini mags have proven to be the most consistent and reliable brand of ammo. Others, he says, I promise, lack efficacy. Other brands tend to vary from production run, and so there's a lot of inconsistency. Sometimes there's feeding and cycling problems. If this happens, it's probably the ammo causing it and not the kit, so check your ammo. He recommends his ammo for the calling for the Glock 17 and 22, the Glocks 19, 23, 26, and 27, the CCI mini mags, 40 grain round nose, not the hollow points. The Remington Golden Bullets, 550, 525 round bonus back, the CCI Blazers, Glocks 20, 21, 29 through 30, the CCI mini mags, 40 grain round nose, not hollow points. Remington Golden Bullets, 550, 525 round bonus back, CCI Blazers. And that's our product spotlight. And so go down to ANC Firearms, talk to Arch Kuntz and the good folks down there and take advantage of this deal. And
so should we use hollow points?
Not hollow points. I got that clear. Pretty forceful here on the show. So
My girlfriend would probably say something different. You weak. Anyway, so now it's the interview, and I'm it's break first. So come back. We got a great interview coming up with John Raines. I'm super excited about this. We don't have people that often from the government sector, the official side. It's going to be awesome. I'm telling you, stick around. It's going to be an awesome interview. Man, woo! Back to Glee Back. We got a great interview. I do want to say it was, I'm not the gun expert. That's Matt. So if you had any questions about the products we talked about, look Matt up at Aaron's Gun Shop at gmail.com. That's his email. The radio is 254-697-6633. But don't call me and ask me some technical gun language. Call Matt. Get in touch with him. We're simulcasting on KMIL 105.1 FM, The Ranch, KRXT 98.5. Check out the Facebook again, aaronsgunshop.com and Aaron's Gun Shop on YouTube. So, our interview, man, I'm so excited. We're with John Reddington, assistant district attorney in Falls County, former assistant district attorney in Milam County. He's the prosecutor for the city of Cameron. Currently, and might I add, a great and awesome former defense attorney. I had a chance to work with John. I think he was better from the defense side, right? But and he gave all that up, the lure of riches and a promising, bright, shining career to take a salary from the state and to work for the man. No, I'm just playing. But I'm so happy to hear he's got some, going to tell us some stuff from the state's point of view, which we don't get to hear a lot of times, and it's really hard to get public officials on here. I'm excited to get you on here and have you tell us what's going on. And so,
it's good to be here.
I think some people say we look alike. I grew mine out a little more. I'll tell a funny story first before we get started. I was at last year. I'm walking at the courthouse square, and some guy's in his truck, like, going around the block. You know, John's a prosecutor. This guy, you know, old crotchy-looking guy's flicking me off. And I'm like, man, what? And I walked up and said, what's going on? He said, oh, I thought you were John Reddington.
Yeah, that's usually the reception I get when I'm out about town.
And so tell us, I've tried cases with you as a defense side, and we've gone against each other. It's been awesome in some of those cases, right?
It's pretty, pretty intense.
Yeah, I know. We love it, though. He's one of my best friends. But say what, now that you're on the state side, what misconceptions maybe when you were a defense lawyer did you have that when you made it to the state, you were like, man, I got it all wrong?
Well, I for number one, I thought it would be easier being a prosecutor, because, you know, being on the defense side, I always felt like the cards were stacked against us.
Yeah.
And, you know, the overwhelming, you know, vast resources of the state were just, it seemed tough to overcome. So once I became a prosecutor, I figured it would be pretty easy. But then that darned old, you know, standard of proof, beyond a reasonable doubt, it's for real. And you know, it's been more challenging than I thought, actually. And you know, it's also challenging because you deal with a lot more cases in terms of quantity. So, you know, whereas, you know, as a defense attorney, you've got, you know, a few big cases a month, but it seems like I've got, you know, about 20 or 30 a month. So
or more,
deal with more cases. But overall, you know, I've liked the change.
And you got the judges telling you, get these cases off my docket.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I thought I would kind of, it would be less stressful, but you still got a boss.
So what is the stresses maybe that you feel from the state side? What are some of the stresses? Because, you know, you don't want to lose. You don't want your client to go to jail. We talked about some of that. You know, trying to fight things is from my side. From your side, what are some of the stresses that you feel?
Well, number one, you want to make sure that justice is done. And that's a really heavy burden to bear. You don't want to prosecute the wrong person or prosecute an innocent person. You know, that's the last thing you want to see. You also, though, you feel like you kind of have the weight of the world on your shoulders, and that if you don't do your job, that you know society could just spiral out of control, and you know, there'd be blood in the streets. You know, so that's some pressure. But and you always worry that, you know, if you don't handle something severely enough or sternly enough, that, you know, an offender might go back out and do something really serious, which has, unfortunately, you know, that's happened to me before. So it's a solemn job. I take it real seriously, but at the end of the day, it's real gratifying.
And so a really good professor of mine, he's a great professor, really well-known military lawyer. He teaches prosecutorial ethics. He told me that integrity consists of three pillars zealousness, competence, and diligence. That was Professor Jeffrey Corney said that that these are the backbone and fundamentals, sort of from a prosecutor standpoint. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. Yep.
And so, from a you were talking about, you know, it's hard. You feel stressed. You want to do this, and so how do you determine how you charge? What you're going to charge with, or do you even make that decision? So they're always asking me the process. What happens from point A to point B? And so, why don't you? What are you looking at? What are some of the things you're going to look? Are you, you know, how do you know when to be zealous, and how do you know when to give mercy? How do you know when to see a case for what it is and not get caught up in the politics? So, I mean, what is justice? Things like that. I mean, enlighten us.
All right.
That was a lot for you, but I'm giving you the opportunity to kind of run with it and tell us.
When it comes to charging, you know, obviously you look at the nature of the crime. You think, is there a victim involved here? Or is this more of maybe a traffic type or a drug type case where it's not your classic victim crime? And then secondly, you look at your defendant, and you look at their history, their background. I try to categorize defendants into some boxes. I think that a lot of crimes are committed by, you know, good people who do something bad, and then sometimes it's good people who just do something stupid, and then you've got bad people who do something stupid, and then you got bad people that do something really bad. So I try to put it in one of those categories and go from there. And I try not to overcharge, because I don't think it's fair. And second, I think juries appreciate it when you are reasonable about what you charge people with. So, I don't try to high play people typically.
Okay.
Unless it's a very, you know, severe criminal, but always, you know, if I don't, all I have to really have is, from a legal standpoint, a standard of proof is probable cause to charge somebody with a misdemeanor or present a case to a grand jury if it's a felony. But really,
what's your grand jury or rubber stamp? You know, I'm just playing.
Right. Ham sandwich. But, you know, I really try to think of it more as, can I prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt?
Good.
And if I can't, I usually get rid of it or charge. Try to charge
folks, I really respect John. He's he's a great lawyer. Okay, but I think that John has a lot of common sense. I think he's always, like I said, he's come after my guys before. He's come after me. I think that he's been the most consistent as far as knowing when to come after people and knowing, you know, when to give temperaments, right, and use some common sense in the scenario. And he's telling you that now. He's looking, what can he prove? Even though he's got probable cause, what can he prove? And I think that's a great attitude to have. But as far as, like, so this is a gun show. We talk about a lot of gun things like that. Do you have maybe an example, maybe if somebody committed some kind of gun crime? What are you going to look if you think you can prove that case?
Some high cap adventures. Yeah, got some of those. I look at...
Let's say this. I think you tried a case in I won't, if you don't want to talk about it, I won't. But I think you tried a good case about shooting at a house or where your client was doing that as a defense lawyer.
Right. I had a client who lived in Houston, and he was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon because it was during dove season, and he lived in sort of a commercially zoned part of Houston, and there were some people that were dove hunting right next to his house, and it had been ongoing for several weeks, and he'd asked them to stop, you know, shooting toward his house, and
were they hitting his house?
Wouldn't stop there. He claimed they were hitting his house and peppering, you know, with birdshot, and he kind of took the law into his own hands and went over there and started shooting his shotgun with birdshot at them. And so they charged him with a second degree felony. They offered him probation. He didn't want to take it. He felt like he was justified in what he did, and he wanted a trial. And this was my very first jury trial. It was in, you know, the high rise courthouse in downtown.
Why did you go to Houston?
Houston?
Was that the lure of riches talking to you down there?
Certainly wasn't. Back, you know, before I was very savvy, I think I got paid, you know, maybe $1,500 up front, which, you know, hardly paid for the travel down there. I was eager to get the experience. And, you know, when it was all said I'll tell you what happened anyway. We got a self-defense instruction in the jury charge, and the jury walked him, acquitted him, which I was amazed. But my first trial was really wet behind the ears, and but it was a great experience, and so my reward though for my Christmas bonus was my client had some hound dog puppies, and he couldn't pay the rest of my fee, but he did give me a hound dog puppy. So
what about the gun?
I did get the shotgun.
He gave you the gun. Was it the same one?
Yeah, it was nice. It was a Remington 1100. Yeah, it was nice.
Yeah. And so from a prosecutor standpoint, would you have charged that guy? Would you have charged him?
I don't think I would have charged him with ag assault with a deadly weapon. It was by threat. I may have gone for a deadly conduct misdemeanor or something like that. But I mean, the kids, they weren't that. I don't think the jury found the victims, quote, very, very sympathetic. Victim-like. Yeah, right.
And it's kind of like one of those, you asked for it.
Right, right. And they were like kind of city boys, and we just went in there and just really countried the place up. I mean, my client was a country boy. I was kind of a country boy. And
folks, he played Lonesome Dove, and I think his last jury trial over here.
So. Right, right. Yeah. That's I love Lonesome Dove.
And so the riches of being a lawyer are maybe misconceptions that the public has many times. Yeah,
right. I mean, I definitely
was the hound dog worth it.
No, the hound dog turned out to be a real bust. gave it away promptly. It was a terrible dog.
I think we had another case, folks. We had I think here in Cameron. John calls me, and I come down. Was I even in law school?
You were in law school.
I think it probably wasn't even legal for me to sit in there. I think Judge Summers let me sit in there.
Yeah.
And we got this. He called me. He's at some Christmas party. He's late, and he's like, "Man, you got paper bags." Yeah. He didn't bring some, not paper bags, but he said, bring some sacks, some sandwich sacks. He didn't really tell me what to bring. And so he shows up, and this
like
is
Ziplocs.
Yeah, like Ziploc baggies. But he shows up the next day, and we've got, he's got this K2. And at that time, the K2.
So synthetic marijuana.
Yeah, the synthetic marijuana.
It was legal back then.
It was legal, but it had just been passed or something. We were kind of leery about it. And then I think it didn't get illegal till the next year.
Sure.
Right?
My client was on trial for possessing marijuana. Real marijuana.
And so we show up, and he's got this, and I've got the bags, and we're sitting there trying to put it into these Ziploc baggies instead of like dime bag. Not that I know what dime bags look like, but we're sitting there trying to put it into these bags to make it look like real marijuana or oregano.
We were going to try to confuse the cop because they didn't test it at a lab. It was just relying on the jury, to believe the cop that, hey, this is marijuana. We were going to try the synthetic stuff, and I don't think that worked, but we ended up winning anyway.
Yeah, the jury loves it. The cop, I mean, you bamboozle him for like a second. He's just like, I don't think they're marijuana.
He did good.
But we kind of you played it off great though. Is what I always think about. You played it off great, and then you go in and try to enter the receipt. From late whenever you picked it up at like Mr. like Nice Guys or Mr. Happy's Place in Killeen. Yeah. Man, the jury loved it, and you walked him, and it was a Fourth Amendment issue, is another deal. I don't think anybody bought the marijuana, but we tried our best.
Yeah, it was a bad stop. They just stopped the kid for just walking across the street.
Yeah,
so. And high crime area.
That's right. So we talked about how much time we got. Okay, we yesterday we were going over some things like if obviously the story about Houston speaks to us that just because you may have a right. To use the weapon, right? It doesn't mean you should.
Right.
Use the
weapon. That case could have easily gone the other way. I think we talked to the jury later, and there were several jurors that wanted guilty, and then they just figured they didn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. But it cost him a lot of money. It cost him one of his prized hound dog pups, and certainly you're not required to retreat or anything like that for self defense in Texas, but. Probably would have been wise for him to have called the game warden or called the police or something before doing that. But just be careful out there. Think. Always try to kind of channel the rifleman. Chuck Connors. He was so fast. He had plenty of time to think about whether or not he really needed to pull the trigger. And then when he did, he would just shoot the gun out of the bad guy's hand.
And so that's what I mean. That's what we talk about. That's why Matt talks about the importance of training. and getting your LTC license to understand what you're doing with the gun, because you know if you're scared when something happens, you're probably not going to use it the right way anyway. Mm-hmm. And so if you're trained and ready to go for it, you are going to be more aware of the situation and be able to make smarter decisions. Do you guys do you have any thoughts on the LTC or something like that? I mean, do you have, because you guys can carry, right?
Yeah, I don't have one, and I don't carry on my person typically unless I'm there's some particular reason to, but I always ride with pretty heavy in the truck, and I'll certainly keep a lot of home defense weapons ready. But one thing just people need to remember, even if they are licensed to carry, you've got to have it in that holster.
Yeah,
that's a new thing.
And we talked about that.
Yeah, don't talk about that. So
yeah, no, go ahead. Tell them. I mean, it's good for.
Well, that was all. But I wanted to talk about one case. It was where we prosecuted it. It was a guy. He's out lived out in the country, and a drunk kid got stuck in his driveway and was passed out. And then the kid woke up, and this guy goes out there with his shotgun, and the kid wakes up and starts spinning his tires and stuff, and the guy shoots out his back window with birdshot, I think, but shoots out the back window of his truck. And, you know, we were kind of leery about it, but we presented it to the grand jury. The grand jury ended up no-billing it. But that was a case where I thought that, you know, he did not feel any that he, it was hard for him to make the argument that he felt like he was in the threat of imminent bodily injury in order to use deadly force.
And so how far off the property maybe was he stuck? Was it right there?
He was on his property in the driveway, but he wasn't anywhere close to the house.
And he was in his own truck.
The guy was in his own truck, so drunk as a skunk.
So. And so we read a National Rifleman article before you got here where a guy broke into the guy's own truck, you know, the homeowner's truck. And is just sitting in the truck. Okay, and the man didn't shoot. Of course, he pointed the weapon at him and told him and subdued him, basically, right? And then called the police right from there. And so, that's a better situation even, and he still didn't fire. And so right. I can see why maybe you guys thought that was inappropriate, especially being in the kid's own truck.
Right. I think you are allowed in Texas to use deadly force to prevent theft
at nighttime.
Got to be at nighttime, which is right. Kind of bizarre,
but, right? And criminal mischief at nighttime.
Criminal mischief, right?
And so, but from that's my standpoint. I can see from your standpoint, from your duty. All I'm saying is I'm defending your decision to maybe think you needed to at least bring something to the grand jury,
right?
And let them make the decision,
right? We and a lot of people kind of mock the grand jury system, but it is an important thing to. Run difficult cases through, you know, to let 12 people, we'll see what they think about it. You know, it's a great system.
And so what else is the system? I mean, they're always asking me kind of what happens. I know how it happens from the Harris County standpoint, but you know, this is small town.
Right.
You know, it's kind of the Wild West. You can still go and get to the judge and talk to the judge if you want, or you can, you know, you've got accessibility, I think, to more courts here. Of course, there's other problems that we have that the big city doesn't have. I mean, is it the Wild West from the prosecutor's standpoint as far as the process is concerned, or are you guys pretty consistent in how things are handled? And I don't mean sloppy. What I mean is it may be a sufficient process, but is it ever different?
Well, we have an investigator at the DA's office that helps screen the cases before they come to a prosecutor, make sure that, you know, all the evidence is there and that each element of every offense we think can be met. And then, you know, we look at it and determine the appropriate charge. It's probably similar. We don't have somebody on call like they do in Houston. You know, people get arrested and we prosecutors hear about it several days later.
Okay.
You know, so sometimes cops will call me on the cell phone on a weekend or something and say, here's what I've got. But that's pretty rare.
We always talk about videoing the police and things like that. I was curious what you thought about, you know, people doing that. Not that I'm going to, you know, we disagree all the time, but I just kind of was curious to see what you had to say.
Well, usually these days they're going to be videotaping themselves. They're going to have body cam or whatever. But, you know, if you feel like you need to do that to help you in court later, yeah, but I'd say it's probably not going to help keep you out of jail that night, you know, in reality. So, you know, do it at your own risk, I guess.
How we doing? Well, that'll give us some time if we, I think we're.
Got
any closing thoughts, maybe?
Yeah, I just want people to know that really the justice system works. I wouldn't think radically about it either way. You know that, oh, law enforcement's terrible, or oh, the, you know, cops are always right, cops are great, you know, and there's bad, and you know, it, you know, just be active as a citizen. You know, go to jury duty, learn a lot from that. It's really important. You know, if you're ever called to be a grand juror, that's a great, great privilege. I think our justice system's pretty strong, but it, obviously it's getting better, I think.
Why do you contend that it's getting better?
Well, I think the pendulum kind of swung very far to like the extremely hard on crime stuff back in the 90s and the early 2000s. And I think in the last 5 to 10 years, it's kind of been swinging back the other way, I think, to where we're focused more on making sure the defendant's rights are respected, and I think the drug laws are getting a little more reasonable, and there's some bail reform,
and there was some grand jury reform.
There's grand jury reform and the Michael Morton Act, you know, to make sure that the discovery of the evidence is made available. So
to put on you guys, what is the Michael Morton Act for everybody?
The Michael Morton Act, basically, Michael Morton was a man who was wrongfully imprisoned for over 20 years.
Does that worry you?
Yes. I mean, that's the last thing I would ever want to have happen.
And so that does the Michael Morton Act protect that kind of stuff?
It's supposed to, you know.
Who knows?
Yeah, it happens. I think it's extremely rare.
It makes you guys give over everything.
Right.
Basically.
Right, right, right. So,
is she ready? Okay. Well, John, I think, man, it was great for you to be on the show.
Thanks for having
again,
me.
Again, folks, this is a great man here. I'm glad that he's somebody that's on the government side. I think if we had more people like John, the system would work even better than it does today. I'm so happy that he's my friend. I'm glad that you came in and gave us some your input and insight into the state side of things. And I hope I don't see you anytime soon, though, really.
Well, Ross, I will say it's good to know that you're out there looking out for people. Yeah. So, thanks for having me.
All right.
All right.
Central Texas Martial Arts of Rocktail offers martial arts classes Tuesdays and Thursdays between 5:30 p.m. and 7 p.m. in their 1,800 square foot facility, which is located in Rockdale at 973 Highway 77. Learn confidence and control with mind and body at the Central Texas Martial Arts Academy in Rockdale. Call or text Master Cindy Key at 254-721-2775 or just stop by. Central Texas Martial Arts Academy in Rockdale, 254-721-2775.
Hi, Master Cindy Key here, and today the tip is, how do you know if somebody's going to punch at you or try to grab you, attack? They do certain things. Number one, you need to be aware. The first thing is always going to be aware of your surroundings. And if you're in front of somebody that looks like they might be trouble, don't be square to them. You know, get in a little side, what I call a side fighting position, but not like you're looking like you're fighting, just kind of comfortable with your hands, you know, in the middle so that you don't look like you're going to start anything. Number one, if they seem like they're causing trouble, you know, try to talk to them first and, hey, you know, I don't want any trouble. You know, if they're throwing insults at you, you know, just try to divert them and redirect their thought process. If that doesn't work, look for your options around you as to how you can get away, and then watch for their demeanor to change, because their demeanor will change. They'll, you know, all of a sudden, their eyes will squint or get bigger, or they'll start talking uglier. Their hands may clench. If they've had their hands open, they may clench their hands. If they're going to, right before they throw a punch, most fighters that I've fought that weren't trained will turn their shoulder, and they'll put their dominant side behind them. So if they're look at them, pay attention if they're right-handed or left-handed, and if they step back, putting their dominant side behind, they're probably going to do something. They're going to kick or throw a punch. Also, right before, some of them will try to fake you out, and they'll kind of turn and maybe even look at you with a smile or something, and then turn and throw that sucker punch at you. So that's the main things to look for when looking for somebody to attack you. Kind of be aware of that. So this is Cindy, Master Cindy Key, at 254-721-2775.